looking at all life through the lens of the Scripture and the teaching of Christ Church.
Cresta in the Afternoon, weekdays from 4 to 6 on 990 WDEO.
Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
My guest today is John Berenson. John's been on the show several times before. He's one of my favorite guests. He's a retired Lutheran minister and author of a book entitled Cross-Shaped Leadership on the Rough and Tumble of Parish Practice, published in 2008. He was a fellow graduate student at Emory University when I was there, and we shared a lot about music. And one thing he shared with me that I'm very grateful for was the introduction to a great Czech pianist who at the time was rather obscure. His name was Ivan Moravec, and he died yesterday. And John wrote a tribute to him on the Christian Review, which I publish and edit. John, what was it about Ivan Moravec's playing that made him so important to you?
Well, thank you for having me back on, Dio. His playing was... you experienced it sounded like pearls. It sounded like fine pearls. It was so smooth, so fastidious, so elegant that any aspect. Of course, the piano was a percussion instrument by definition.
You would know it more of it.
Right, right. I mean, one of the things that Horowitz prized because he used to listen to a lot of opera was to try to make the piano sing like an Italian opera singer. Well, more of it. Really, really succeeds here is that there's no sense of the percussive at all, no sense of harshness. It is so smooth. I don't want to say smooth in the sense of mushy, but now some of that has to do with the fact that he was very interested, more so than most artists, in he was really a piano technician. He would work with the technicians before not
really?
The recordings. Not only recordings, but before performances. So he would go over, that aspect of it. And
do you know what kind of piano he played, John?
I think he played a Steinway. I actually think he played what they call a Hamburg Steinway. That is the German-made Steinway.
He didn't play a Bechstein or some...
I think, it sounds like a Bechstein, or it sounds like... a Burzendorfer. It has that kind of smooth, but yet a Burzendorfer, when you listen to it, has that beautiful, smooth, vanilla sort of sound, but it also doesn't have a tremendous amount of depth. It's a little bit shallow. I think he's playing a German Steinway is what it was. But unlike a Horowitz who demanded that his pianos be sent along with him, even on the airplane, he had to have the piano flown in. I mean, he was that much of a diva. More of it didn't have that kind of, he didn't have that kind of luster that he could demand that. So he would come to a place, and apparently one of the stories was that in 1954, when George Zell, the great conductor of the Cleveland Orchestra, invited him to play the Beethoven Fourth, they quarreled over not only the interpretation, but they quarreled over which piano to use and how it was being serviced. And they had the performance, but then after that, he was kind of on a blacklist because of the influence of George Zell and didn't play in the United States for another 5 years. But it was all over which piano to use and how it was tuned and how it was registered. He was an absolute perfectionist with that. So when you hear the famous recording of the Nocturnes, again, it's like from out of this world. The sound is so ethereal and I don't want to say creamy, but like pearls, almost like liquid silver is the way I would use it. That's an odd phrase.
Well, speaking of Ivan Moravec's recordings of the Nocturnes, I have a treat for you. Let's listen to the first Nocturne for piano in B-flat minor by Frédéric Chopin. Well, John, when you hear the opening of the of that first nocturne played by Ivan Moravec, you know something very special is going to happen.
It makes you hold your breath, even to this day. I've had those recordings since the 1960s. It makes you hold your breath. It takes you into a kind of suspended animation and beauty, and yet it's firmly anchored in the rhythm and the discipline, and it's just that the rhythm and the discipline disappears into the beauty of the music. I mean, it's pretty unearthly in my.
You know, opinion. It's funny because it's great that you reminded me of that recording because I've owned it on vinyl and on CD. First, the vinyl came out in the late 60s or mid 60s. And I re-listened to the entire set several times since yesterday. And the thing that struck me about his playing was how it felt like with each nocturne he was telling a story.
Mm-hmm.
There was a kind of linearity, you know, but it was a gentle horizontal pressure. But it was just not hanging in the air, which is what you get with some Chopin playing.
What also, I mean, he is from Czechoslovakia, and he is from that, you know, wasn't Polish, but he was Czech. He is into not only the sound world of something like Chopin, but into the cultural, and I don't want to say spiritual world, because there's nothing particularly overtly religious about Chopin, but he's from that quarter, he's from that neck of the woods in Europe, and I think his sense of identification with it is very heartfelt. It's almost like a next door neighbor, you know.
Poland meets Czechoslovakia.
Yeah. I mean, he's obviously in honoring that. I mean, his countrymen were people like Smetana and Dvorak, and they have piano music, but it's fairly minor piano music. No, it's just, you know, the polish. Now, his recording a few years later...
on Supraphon. This was on Connoisseur Society, which is no longer out there, but...
Right.
Yeah.
But I got it on Supraphon. I don't know. Now, I think Connoisseur Society, I think that's actually a second recording. I think Connoisseur Society had a Preludes, and the Supraphon, I believe, was another later recording.
I agree, it was.
But again, you hear the playing on the Preludes, and when he does launch into something very virtuosic, I don't want to portray this as all just kind of creepy,
yeah,
dreamy, because there's fire in his belly. When he'll get a virtuoso prelude, or another one of my favorite recordings of his is of the Beethoven Les Adieux Sonata from the 60s. When he lets it rip, it's all the more telling because of how intimate, and the contrasts are so startling. The Preludes has that same effect, but then they have a lot of virtuoso pieces in the Preludes. So there you get to see the other side of him, which is really the virtuoso.
As you do in his recording of Chopin's ballades and scherzi, and mazurkas, for that matter.
Yes, yeah. Recently, I did not know the existence recently. This was before I learned of his death. I was just doing some buying, and I didn't know there was a recording of any of the piano sonatas of Chopin. And sure enough, there's one of the second piano sonata. My favorite recording of that has always been either Horowitz or Pariah. But then I listened to this thing, and I just became, it's being recomposed before my eyes.
I want to remind our listeners that I'm talking to John Berenson, who writes regularly for the Christian Review and often about music. In fact, you not too long ago, John, you wrote a piece about Horowitz, who I guess is your other favorite pianist. It seems kind of interesting that you put Moravec and Horowitz up there because they seem to me, at least, very different kind of people.
Very, very, very different. And, you know, I describe Horowitz sometimes as a guilty pleasure because, I heard him twice in public. Once I drove when I was in Atlanta when we first met. I heard that he was going to play at Constitution Hall in Washington. I drove all the way on my own. And I don't know how long that is. Is that 500 miles or something like that? But I drove all the way from Atlanta to D.C. to hear Horowitz. And I don't remember much about the recital. It must have not been that outstanding. But then he showed up in Atlanta in like 77. And I did hear him there, and there was that big venue there, that big civic auditorium or something in Atlanta. Now, that was like watching the Buddha walk on us.
I was there with you, I believe.
He ended with the Liszt Mephisto Waltz in the Busoni rearrangement of it. And it just, it just tore the house apart.
I know.
You know what? But if I look at just the intimacy and quality musically, I have to say that the two greatest piano recitals I ever attended were this one of Moravec in 82 at Carnegie, and one I might have mentioned to you before when I was in England in 1969, the great Wilhelm Kempf from Germany played an all Schumann and Brahms concert. Now, artistically, those were the two most just mature, I mean, just feast of music that I've ever attended. And I heard Rostropovich in New Haven, and he was unbelievable at a two-hour recital.
A cello recital?
Right, yeah. And then I heard Elizabeth Schwarzkopf making an American farewell tour, and she was, again, off the charts.
Great soprano.
Yeah, yeah.
But I want to get back to Chopin and Moravec, and I have another surprise for you, and that is his third nocturne, which is in B major key, played again by Ivan Moravec from this first set of recordings for Connoisseur Society from the mid-60s. Let's listen to it. John, I don't think I've ever heard eighth notes played like that.
Yeah, apparently as a young person, his father was very interested in opera. And there's a story about Moravec listening to the records of Caruso and crying. He thought it so beautiful. And, you know, Caruso and some of the great tenors had what they used to call, quote, the tear in the voice. That was true of Gigli. That was true of Björling.
Pavarotti, and, too.
Yeah. There's that so-called tear in the voice. And Moravec started out as an opera lover. And you could hear, the emotion, the kind of tearfulness. I'm getting too psychological here, but it's there. The way he stretches a line, suspends a rhythm, and yet it falls back into its normal rhythm. And nothing is tossed off. You know, if it's an ornament or, as you say, an eighth note or a trill, nothing is just tossed off. Each thing is treated as worthy of dwelling upon, and yet it's kept within. It's kept within the rhythm and the piece. And so the singing quality, the only person that has a similar singing quality and would be Horowitz at times. When Horowitz was not barnstorming, there are moments, if you hear some of Horowitz's best playing is with Scarlatti sonatas or when he plays like mazurkas of Chopin, then you get to hear the real Horowitz genius, the singing quality. Very different than this one because this is a rich singing quality that is just, it makes me want to sing, you know, and I don't even know how to sing this piece.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading about the nocturnes, again, getting ready to talk to you, and one thing that one commentator says is that the nocturnes are characterized by a very pronounced right-hand melody.
Yeah.
So that makes almost each nocturne a kind of song.
Right. And there's almost a kind of rocking, how should I put it, as a person who doesn't really know music theory very well, unlike my family members, there is a kind of rocking a rocking rhythm, almost like a, you know, child in the cradle rhythm to the stuff. And that's what I think is so consoling and soothing. You feel you're being, if I'm not being too kind of mushy here, you feel like you're being cradled and rocked in something very, very, you know, that's the way I feel about it.
Yeah, I mean, you feel like you are kind of being told a bedtime story. Let's listen to a third selection from the Chopin Nocturnes. This time it's his number 8 in D-flat major, played by Ivan Moravec. John, I mentioned it has the effect of a bedtime story, and then I heard that, and I thought, whoa, that's a pretty good description.
And it, you know, as I'm sitting there, I'm going, well, this is like a perfect arc. It's a perfect arc. It, nothing along the way is left unattended in terms of the attention to the detail, and yet it's not fragmented. It makes me want to cry, and yet I don't
know
why.
You know, John, you were saying a moment ago that you know little about musicology, and either do I, but that's really the point. I want to read you a short passage from my favorite writer on music, Victor Zukerkandel, who published 3 books for Princeton University Press. Back in the 50s and 60s, he was a teacher at St. John's College in Annapolis, but he was from Vienna. And he immigrated to the U.S. to avoid Hitler. And what the point he makes in his at the beginning of his book entitled The Sense of Music is that the experience of great music does not presuppose a special gift or learning. This is precisely the unique thing about music. It speaks a language that is understood without learning, understood by everyone, not just by the so-called musical people. And, you know, if you were to read Einstein's Physics, or if you were to read Kant's Critique of Judgment, or if you were to read any great theoretical work, unless you're a specialist, you wouldn't have a clue. But you can listen to this great composition by Chopin without any education, and you can be moved to tears.
I read a couple of years ago a book that my son, who's a musician, he's a music teacher, when I was out at Indiana University in Bloomington, where he went, great music school, that was a bestseller at the time called This Is Your Brain on Music. Now, the fellow who wrote it is from Canada, and he's one of these brain researchers, and he subsequently published another bestseller in the whole area. But one of the things I remember he said with brain research and music is, there's almost no music that you and I couldn't become acclimatized to, with one exception. So we could become acclimatized if we lived in Southeast Asia to the different modes there. It's also why Beethoven is so universal and loved in Asian countries. You and I could be, we could become what they call it, enculturated to almost any tonalities of different cultures. The one exception being atonal music. So they found that the so-called second Viennese school, Berg, Schoenberg, and Weber, and the so-called 12-tone atonal music is the only one they've discovered so far that is not adaptable to any culture.
Or to anybody's ear, per se.
Right, and hence, I was thinking about this in the run-up to our interview. I go to concerts all the time. The number of times, even today, that one of their pieces is on a symphonic program is very rare.
They're gone, thank God.
Yeah, I heard the Berlin Philharmonic a few years ago here in Philadelphia, and they had a Brahms symphony and a very short Webern piece at the beginning, and, you know, as a kind of a tribute. But it somehow doesn't carry culturally. And, of course, that is probably what they wanted.
Because it was written as a theoretical expression. Let's get back to real music. Let's listen to another of Chopin's nocturnes, number 19. This happens to be the final nocturne, at least in the Moravec set. There are three other nocturnes, 20 and 21. No, two other nocturnes. But in the Moravec set, the 19th, the E minor nocturne, here played by Ivan Moravec. John Berenson, this, the 19th of the Nocturnes, actually was written very early. It was written before the rest. He wrote the Nocturnes over 20 years. He wrote the last one in the year he died, and he in 1846. And that particular one, as I listened to it, I think some pop music writer ripped him off, because I could have broken into a song. I'm not sure if I would have gotten the lyrics right. Dee da da dee da da. That's in some popular ballad. I'm not sure what it is.
Also E minor, and again, I could be wrong, but I think I'm correct here. The first thing I thought of is that E minor is the key of the Beethoven Eroica Symphony, the great third symphony. And if you hear that slow movement, dum bum 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 bum,
right,
the funeral movement, there's a Beethovenian quality there because E minor has that key. Now, the only person I've heard who can approach more of it there is a Horowitz recording of that E minor that is also just meltingly gorgeous. But again, the words you want to use are something like melting.
Yes.
Melting, and yet that makes it sound that it doesn't have any spine to it, but it does. He knows just enough to stretch a line and then make sure it doesn't get out of control, that it still falls within the discipline of the rhythm. You know what it is? This is a person who he's playing the music from within. He's playing the music from within. It's been internalized in him, and he's playing as if he is inside of it. And that's immediately recognizable.
It is. And we have more to play, and we're going to do that after our break here in a few minutes. But let me ask you this question. It is said that Chopin owed to an Irish composer named John Field concept of writing a nocturne.
Yeah, the actual form of what you're talking about here, this kind of free form, nighttime music for Benny By, was, and you can buy very fine records. There are very fine records in the last 20 years or so. There are many fine performances of the John Field Nocturnes. There's probably, I don't know how many nocturnes there are, but there's a whole handful, a record or two worth of John Field Nocturnes, and you listen to them, and they're, they don't have anywhere near the sophistication, the kind of Parisian sophistication that the Chopin have. But you can see where the form came from, the free form, the rocking, the kind of nighttime music. Yes, and I think I have one record somewhere of them.
One commentator said that Chopin combined Field's sort of format with the singing line of a Bellini aria.
Yep, right, yep.
You know, what's interesting to me is that even though these were written over 20 years, they are, in a way, of a piece. And with that comment, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with John Berenson talking about Chopin and the beauties of music in just a moment.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I am Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, the Feast of the Assumption, the Dormition of the Mother of God, is a stirring example of how the two lungs of the Church, East and West, breathe together. Yet this feast is also profoundly relevant for our times.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO, Ave Maria Radio.
Hi, this is Father John Ricardo, inviting you to join me as we explore some of the deepest questions that arise in our hearts, questions that shape the way we think, the way we speak, and the way we live. For all of these questions, Christ is the answer.
On the next Christ is the Answer program, Father Ricardo talks with a men's group about the necessity of praying and reading Scripture. His titles are, What We Have Here is a Failure to Communicate, Prayer, Quality Time with a Father, and The Single Best Personal Trainer, Scripture. Listen to Christ is the Answer Wednesday evenings at 8, Saturday evenings at 6, and Sunday mornings at 11 on Ave Maria Radio and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. He is the image of the invisible God. He points us to our destiny. He reveals the dignity of the human person. He is the one who makes known the Father. Christ is the Answer.
Christ is the Answer is brought to you by the Ave Maria Communications Guild.
Hi, Deacon Tom here with a reminder that Ave Maria Radio has some terrific gift ideas for you. Books by our hosts and our guests, recordings on CD, and our new Wi-Fi radios so you can listen to Catholic radio anywhere in the world, anytime you want, as long as you have a Wi-Fi connection. Just go to our website and click the word store in the navigation bar at the top of the page. It's an easy way to shop, and you can help Catholic radio at the same time. The website can be found at AveMariaRadio.net.
Back with John Berenson, and we're talking about Chopin and the pianist Ivan Moravec, who died yesterday. And here is Moravec's recording of the ninth nocturne in B major. John, that was, again, the ninth nocturne, the B major nocturne of Frédéric Chopin. It's just amazing how he can just play a little, like a four-note build toward a chord, and you just feel the tension toward the toward the resolution of that.
One of the parts of his biography that when they asked him how he developed this kind of delicate style, and you can see this in the tribute for the New York Times, is that he traced this style in part to a skating injury when he was a kid.
Really?
I guess he was ice skaters like a lot of those folks in those areas. And
I was an ice skater, but I never learned how to play the piano like that. Go ahead.
I had an operation on my sinuses, and I asked the doctor. I said, you know, well, my voice starts sounding like Pavarotti now. It's a little bit, you know. He said, no, it'll change a little bit, but I can't guarantee that. But
so what happened to Moravec that made it help his pianism?
Skating accident, and according to the biography, it left him weak and ill. It must have been something neurological. And at age 18, although he started playing piano at age 7, at age 18 he just simply stopped at age 18. And for a while, then all of a sudden, in 1954, this was the year that he got invited by Zell. They just disappeared, these neurological symptoms. But one of the things that you see, if you see him in person, you can see it a little bit on the YouTube videos and even in the pictures, the photographs. You notice his posture at the bench is fairly, how should you put it? It's very, very, his back is like straight as a board.
Very Prussian.
Yes. And according to him, that's not because of some attitude. That was because of this accident. And even though he had to do that to compensate, but also even after the symptoms had left him, he never felt totally safe in that regard. So he maintained that kind of stiff as a board, Prussian posture, lest some of the symptoms come back, a neurological or something in his spine or his back. And that, too, he said, affected how his actual keyboard touch made it much more, he had to be self-aware in terms of the delicacy of it. And that just carried over even to when the illness disappeared.
You know, as I listened to that last Nocturne, the ninth, I thought, this guy has got to be a great Mozart player. You know what I mean by that?
Yeah. Oh, yes. In fact, there are some sonatas. You can get those, and they're lovely. And there's a set of, in fact, I just got them in the last couple of days, knowing we might talk.
You've been putting them off.
Yeah, well, there was this, he started a series with Sir Neville Mariner and the Academy of St. Martin's in the Field on Hansler back about 20 years ago. And he did two discs, and they're widely available. Of the late piano concertos, like 20, 24, 23, and I don't know, 25, the late great, and you listen to it. Of course, Neville Mariner was a great Mozart.
One of the best, yes.
Yeah. So Mozart, Mariner and Moravec do these four concerti, these two discs. I got them the other day. I hadn't had them before. I knew of them. So I started listening to them, and you know, I have the complete set of Murray Pariah,
which is considered perhaps the best complete set.
Sure. And then I have a lot of selected, but people like Alfred Brendel, whom I also heard in London live. But I would say these, again, that's saying a lot, but I think they surpass the Pariah and the Brendel. They're fairly subtle, but the same qualities are there. That's the same.
Did you know that Moravec had recorded the Brahms Second Piano Concerto?
Yes, and he did it, I think he did it more than once. He late in his career, about 20 years ago, he did one and two with the Czech Philharmonic on Superphone, and the conductor is a very fine conductor called, like, Bilovec or something like that.
Yes.
He's the chief conductor of the Czech Philharmonic, which is a very fine orchestra. It's one of the great orchestras of Europe. He did both of them as an integral set, and they're very well regarded. Now, again, they're not heaven-storming. My favorite of the Brahms remain Leon Fleischer in Cleveland, which is from the early 60s. And also the ones by Nelson Freer.
And Emile Gilel.
Yeah, and Gilel's. Those are the great ones. This is at their level. And it's fine recording, too, because it's only like about, it's still from the digital era. But yeah, he made it, but I think he did Rahm's second, independently of that as well. But he did both of them with the Czech Philharmonic within the last 20 years. And they're right up there with Jalel.
And by the way, to our listeners, I'm looking as we talk, and you can get on iTunes these Brahms concerti for $3 a piece on iTunes.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of music for $3.
Oh, that's one of the things I've discovered, you know, you and I and others who are involved with this type of hobby or this type of passion. We had to go through the grief of the closing of some years
ago. Tower Records.
And we couldn't anymore go into
the... It was awful. It was like a divorce. Or I know, it's like a death of a loved one.
I felt like I'd lost my dearest relative.
I mean, is there any place in the world you can go and be in an environment like that anymore for a classical music lover?
The thing was, it was had what they called deep inventory, and they, you know, which means you could get...
And lots of weirdos walking around who were great to talk to.
You could get Czechoslovakian folk. I mean, I'm Norwegian. I found one once. You know, I can get Norwegian fiddle music there. You know, you could get. There's what they call Scandinavian cow calling music for the tunes. You could get anything like that. But of course, that's also why they went out of business. You know, but I will say that now, and I say now using that service called Archive Music. I don't know who invented that, and if it was English first or American, but it is quite wonderful. Do you know Archive Music?
Oh, of course. I get an email from them every Friday night with their weekend special.
I mean, and I don't know if that's originally in English, but it's a wonderful service because it does what the old.
It's Tower Records Online.
Right, and it's also Gramophone Online, and it's also the old Penguin Guides online. So if you want to look up and say, well, I want these nocturnes, who does nocturnes? You know, you look them up and you say, well, there's Moravitz, and then there's, you know, then there's Rubinstein, and this, and you get nice little reviews. Some of them are snippets of older reviews, but it's very, very reliable, and I'm appreciative. So, you know,
John, have you made the transition into downloading yet? Or are you still doing CDs?
I don't get hard copy CDs anymore unless it's something that I just want to take with me to the nursing home, as they say. So
you don't think that you'll be playing downloads in the nursing home?
Well, I don't know. I don't trust the cloud. I don't know the cloud. I mean, you know. I mean, I'm pretty cloudy myself at age 67. So how do I know if I just downloaded this more of it, say, if that like the new set of nocturnes, which I'm going to get, the remastered. Well, they're not available on downloads anyway. But I don't trust it. I got to take it with me to, as they say, the home, you know. So I feel that way. So I'm still kind of old school about, you'd have to say, for instance, the greatest recording of all time, the Carlos Kleiber Beethoven 5 and 7.
Which you've written about for the Christian Review. Now, but...
You have to have that by your bedside, next to the Bible.
Do you ever listen to your vinyl recordings anymore?
I'm ashamed to say, because I saw you wrote something recently about you're still...
I listen more to vinyl at home now than any other medium when I'm listening to music.
Well, now you're one of these hipsters now because it's back. Well, I am ashamed to say I sold my collection of a couple thousand of them.
Oh,
20 years ago.
You're no longer eligible to be a guest on the Church and Culture.
That's fine.
It's not fine.
It's called the Princeton Record Exchange, and I don't know if it's still there.
It is. It is.
I sold my whole collection, I've almost acquired everything from that collection in CD now. But I hear it. And now when you go to Barnes and Noble, and they'll tell you what Barnes and Noble.
Yeah, and there's a big table of vinyl records when you come in the door.
And they have said the other week. I said, "How are sales?" They said, "Ever since we got back into the vinyl, we're doing much better, and it's really helped us." But I got to tell you, Neil, I also remember the days when you had to buy all the dishwasher products and clean the dust and deal with the pops, and I can't handle it. I just can't handle it.
Well, you've always been fastidious in that way. Because, I mean,
I remember I get one little pop on one of the vinyls, and I would think, you know, I was almost like what they call the jot and the tittle of the Bible. I was violating a commandment or something like that.
Well, you know, Moravec, in his own way, is a kind of fastidious player. Although, you, he's got heart, lots of heart, and so his fastidiousness doesn't become dry and cynical.
Well, you know, his mentor, the one that invited him to the, and I wrote about this, and it's written in all of the whether it's the obits or his biographies, one of the great influences is when Arturo Benedetti Michelangeli, the great and legendary Italian pianist and reclusive, invited him to master classes in the 50s, like 57, and recognized him more of as a kind of a fellow spirit. Now, Michelangeli's recordings are few. His performances were few. He was a Debussy specialist. I had tickets to see him once, and he canceled. He canceled over one half of his concerts, and I was devastated. But he did a series of master classes with Michelangeli. So some of also what you're hearing with that ultra sheen and polish is from Michelangeli. But again, if you listen to Michelangeli, sometimes there can be a kind of harshness or a lack of depth or an aloofness. When you come to Moravec, there's no aloofness. The warmth is there with the polish. That's what I really like.
You know, the one thing that I wish Moravec had recorded, or I hope that somebody finds on some sort of radio archive, are his performances of the two Chopin piano concerti.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't even know if it exists.
I mean, those would be to die for. I mean, given his, I think it's an unsurpassed approach to Chopin. I mean, do you think there's any? I mean, what Chopin playing do you think is on the same level with Moravec?
Well, you'd have to say if you're willing to say, okay, that's too obvious. There are times. I mean, Rubinstein, historically, and I heard him once give an all Chopin concert, and what was interesting about that was, half of it he just announced on the stage. He would say, well, I'm going to do these three etudes. I mean, he was amazing. Rubinstein was the kind of, he loved audiences. He almost like made love to the audience.
Well, he said he always picked out one woman in the audience to play to.
Oh, and you felt it yourself. You know, the guy's like, he's got his handkerchief up there and he's like, I love you. Let's go out for champagne. And I heard him in Minneapolis. But Rubinstein's touch is close to this, and Rubinstein, of course, is a larger artist in the sense that...
When you say that he's the one who made Chopin very popular in the United States through his recording?
Rubinstein, and then in Europe, the Italian who died tragically...
Ciccolini.
Young.
No, not Ciccolini.
No, Dino Lupati.
Lupati, right.
Italian. Lupati is a recording of the waltzes, which is just unbelievable. But Rubinstein is the one who popularized, but not in a bad sense. No, Rubinstein was a genius. You listen to his recordings of anything of Chopin, and they are at the Moravec level. It's just that Moravec.
They are, but they're somehow the Moravec is more compared side by side. The Moravec is more compelling even than Rubinstein.
I think there's more attention to detail. I think there's more attention to the intimacy of detail. And so when you hear it, you are drawn into a kind of world in which you feel that you're all alone with Chopin. He erases boundaries. I mean, that's what makes it kind of mystical.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that because one of the things that I wanted to draw to your attention was another passage in my favorite writer on music, Victor Zukerkandel, where he's trying to describe the experience of music, and this is in his book Sound and Symbol, Music and the Eternal World, and he argues that the experience of music collapses the boundaries between the yourself and the world between the interior world and the exterior. It brings it together.
Yeah.
Now, is that hard to understand, do you think?
No. I mean, I think that could be understood if you're listening to, one of the, for instance, outside of the classical sphere, if you take an album like the Frank Sinatra album that he put out when he broke up with who?
With Columbia. When he was at Columbia? Or?
No. When one of his wives walked away from him, a famous woman walked away from him, and one of his, I think it was Only the Lonely. There's from the late 50s, one of his great albums. And don't put that on if you're in a bad mood, because you're going to need extra medication.
You're going to pull the gun out, okay?
I mean, it was one of his wives, a very famous actress. I forget who it was. It was
Ava Gardner.
When she walked away and said, "I've had enough," he produces this album called Only the Lonely, and you do not want to be alone in the middle of the night.
Well, if Ava Gardner walked away from me, I'll tell you, you wouldn't want to be around me. But let's get back to happier music. Let's listen to the 11th of Chopin's Nocturnes in G minor, played by the man we're talking about that we're dedicating this show to, Ivan Moravec. John, speaking of the mood of sadness, there's obviously a mood of sadness in this particular nocturne, which was composed in 1838. That's when he was living with the French novelist George Sand, a woman novelist.
Oh, yeah.
Who is quite notorious for always wearing men's clothes and having very famous lovers. Her longest love, though, was Frédéric Chopin. What kind of impact do you think Sand had on Chopin?
I really wouldn't know, except that I think his own spirit. Now, did she walk away from him?
No, they stayed together more or less till his death.
I'm trying to think. She was married, right, to somebody else?
Yes, she was when they met. Yes. She left. She took her children and left her husband to live with Chopin.
I'm thinking with his delicate sensibilities, and I think he had...
And his proclivity to illness as well.
Yes. I mean, he was a classic one that we hear about in the world of literature and the arts, the one with a delicate constitution who was consumptive, that kind of thing. They'd use that as a generic term.
Yeah. By the way, she left him 1 year before he died. So she stayed to within a year.
And he was only in his 30s, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know the biography that well, but I can only imagine that kind of. Well, I don't know. I mean, that kind of sadness, does that come biographically? I really don't know. I mean, his music, to me as a whole, doesn't read the way, say, Berlioz. When he composed the Symphonie Fantastique, he's in grieving over the English Shakespearean lady that he fell in love with, and he's
the actress.
Going through all Yeah. And I don't know that it's that.
Well, Chopin, if you recall, I mean, he was 39 when he died. I've confirmed that. But you remember he was forced to leave Poland for political reasons.
I did not know that.
So he was literally in exile in Paris, and from what I've read, he suffered a great deal from being, you know, away from his country. I mean, from what I understand, Poles have a very strong sense of belonging to their nation, to their community.
Well, it's no accident then that one of the reasons that the modern person, Ivan Morovitz, didn't get out a lot was that he was behind the Iron Curtain, and he refused to join the Communist Party. I mean, it wasn't like being under Stalin or something like that, where you might get, you know, knocked off. But because he wouldn't join the party, the cultural apparatus in Czechoslovakia just didn't do a lot of promotion of him. They just kind of let him languish. Now, he was a wonderful professor at this academy in Prague, which is where he was working when he died. But the government wasn't about to promote this genius musician because he just, you know, he wasn't a rabble rouser.
He wasn't a party man.
Yeah.
And let's listen to, we have time to listen to one more of his wonderful nocturnes as played by Morovec. This is the 13th. It's very well known. It's C minor, played by Ivan Morovec. We have a minute left, I'm sorry to say. What would you like to say about both Morovec and Chopin? Summarize what we've been talking about.
They are, for a quiet Sunday afternoon, they are for the time between 4 and 6 o'clock before the family comes home. And you might have a little sip of something, whatever it might be. They are for a time when you need to shut out the world. And because they're kind of like a Parisian salon, and you need to allow yourself to be simply clothed in it. I'm getting very poetic here. But when I listen to Chopin, everything else around must be kind of hushed, because you're going to miss some subtlety. That's what I think. And
well,
I feel the same way about the mazurkas. I have a wonderful set of, the only really wonderful set of mazurkas is by Ashkenazi, and that which is wonderful, and of the complete mazurkas, and Rubinstein. I feel the same way. You listen to the mazurkas, you listen to the nocturnes, you must simply shut the world out.
John Berenson, writer for the Christian Review, retired Lutheran pastor and good friend. Thanks for being my guest again on Church and Culture.
Thank you, Dale.
And we'll be back with John at some future date. And those of you who have been listening, please join me on Church and Culture at this time and on this day next week. Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about Church and Culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.
Life and the Pro-Death camps were both rocked last November when Abby Johnson, the director of the Planned Parenthood Clinic in College Station, Texas, resigned after watching an abortion on an ultrasound screen.
And my supervisor said, you know, Abby, you've really got to get your priorities straight. Abortion needs to be your priority because that's where our money is.
Abby Johnson took a journey from Planned Parenthood to pro-life.
I was thinking about all of the women that I had lied to. What if they had known the truth? It's not just some tissue. It is a baby.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting On the Mind of Christ. Following the March for Life, we'll have an interview with Abby Johnson and a very recent talk by John and Mary Lockwood, who experienced the power of God's forgiveness following abortions. Listen to Putting on the Mind of Christ this and every Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Fully Alive. Reflections on the scripture readings of today's Mass with Father Pat Egan, chaplain of Ave Maria Radio.
The human body taken on by the Son of God in his incarnation extends the Eucharist, the bread and wine transformed by the power of God into Christ's body. The same flesh and blood full of divinity is presented to us in the Eucharist and accompanies the Church until the end of time, bringing her every grace and supernatural gift which she receives. One thing more is necessary. One must eat this flesh and drink this blood. Believing that Christ's flesh and blood are here present under the appearances of bread and wine isn't enough. You must partake of them to receive what they carry. And what they carry is everything belonging to the Son of God: his life, his divinity, his death, resurrection, his ascension into heaven. Just as I have life because of the Father, so also the one who feeds on me will have life because of me. At the Jewish Passover, the lambs were both a sacrifice to God and a meal for the people. The lamb was slain as an offering, yes, but it was also slain to be eaten. There's so much more that could be said about the Eucharist. It's an endless mystery. I speak about it fearfully, lest I misstate something. To quote the theologian Father Conor O'Neill, the logic of the union of the Word made flesh with humanity was not fully developed in the womb of Mary. More is revealed at the Last Supper, when the incarnate Word took into his hands a piece of bread and said, "This is my body." Christianity is not just incarnational, it's Eucharistic. I'm Father Pat Egan, chaplain to Ave Maria Radio, commenting on the readings read this Sunday at Mass. Remember, inspired by the Word of God, you can be more fully alive.
You remember the day you first laid eyes on her. They handed you the keys and you drove back home for everyone to admire. And although the memories have been made, it's time to pass the torch to someone else. Consider donating your vehicle to Ave Maria Radio. Even if it's not running, we'll take care of everything from pickup to your tax receipt. Just call 866-628-CARS to show you just how easy it is to donate. That's 866-628-CARS. And mention Ave Maria Radio.
On the next Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
We'll keep you closely connected to the faith with the latest from Rome, the front line.